At 0800 hours, prisoner Murphy,
through carelessness on his part, was found dead in vent shaft 17. He seems to have been sucked into a ventilator. Prisoners Boggs and Rains are missing. There seems to be a good chance that they have met with foul play at the hands of prisoner Golic. We need to organize and send out a search party. I can only hope we are able to all pull together over the next few days until the rescue team arrive for Lieutenant Ripley.
It's here. You got Clemens.
Stop this, Ravy, at once.
I'm telling you. It's here.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Alien Retrospective Series.
Is this going to be a stand-up fight, sir, or another bug hunt?
Join Garrett.
Check it out. I am the ultimate badass.
Yes,
state of the badass art. You do not want to fuck with me.
Matt.
I work for the company, but don't let that fool you. I'm really an okay guy.
And Adam.
You've been in my life so long, I can't remember anything else.
As they go to another system and investigate the popular horror science fiction series where no one can hear you scream.
This is so nuts. I mean, listen to what you're saying. It's paranoid delusion. It's really sad.
From the 1979 original.
Take a look at this, man.
All the way through Alien Romulus, this newest installment coming out this year.
Did IQs just drop sharply while I was away?
The boys will examine each film individually and find out what the company's real intentions are.
Looks like love at first sight to me.
So strap yourselves in, podcast listeners.
Stand by.
The Percolated Media Alien Retrospective begins now.
Let's go!
Alien Resurrection, released November 26, 1997. Budget on this was $70 million. Box office, $161.4 million, even though only 47 of that is from the United States. And this is directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet. All right, guys. Alien Resurrection. This was my first Alien theatrical experience. And I gotta say, the advertising came out for this. By the time this had come out, I had seen all the other ones. I had already pretty much cemented it as one of my favorite franchises. And I was really excited when this movie was coming out. Adam, you did not see this with me, as we established before we hit record on this. What were you thinking when you heard, oh God, they're doing a fourth Alien film?
I was excited because the other three, and yeah, I'll say all three, I mean, they'd become just so important in movies that I loved and the characters and everything else. So as much as you killed off Ripley last week, yeah, oh, you're going to do another one? Absolutely. And the marketing for this, the lines and stuff like that, it was a quippy freaking trailer. But man, I was ready and heady to go back, and I'm really excited to see what they were going to do with it.
All right, Matt, you really tore Alien 3 a new one last week. Of course, this was the Alien Resurrection was already out by the time you started it. Were you even looking forward to watching this at all?
I ripped the new one after 20th Century Fox ripped, burnt, and defecated on the old one. So I felt like I was just doing God's work at that point. And when I heard there was a fourth one, I had no desire to watch this. And I watched it out of obligation, not necessarily because I wanted to. Much like Alien 3, I was surprised at how tumultuous the production history of this movie was, although I shouldn't be surprised because once is a coincidence, twice is a pattern. And I feel bad for whoever took this on, because you'll watch the end of Alien 3, you're like, this is pretty cut and dry as far as the book being shut. How do you make another one? Well, you look at the subtitle Resurrection, that's as literal as you can get.
Yeah, and you know what? We mentioned last week that Alien 3 was not a box office hit in America, but you know where it was a big hit, boys, was overseas. It made a lot of money, and I think that particular fact has a lot to do with who we ended up with as director of this. So let's go through the directors that were attached to this for a while. A guy by the name of Danny Boyle had just done Trainspotting, and that was the first person they courted for this. And he was willing to play ball for a bit, but of course, 20th Century Fox balked. They kind of delayed this a few times, and by the time they were ready to give him a go, he had already moved on to A Life Less Ordinary. Matt, Danny Boyle as an Alien 4 director, I might be able to see that.
Well, especially if you've seen Sunshine.
Yes.
You know, that showed he could do big science fiction. Although that movie's a lot smarter than Alien 3. I don't know if he would have done what the studio seemingly was aiming for in their trajectory. The only difference, I think, would be instead of Ron Perlman and Dominic Essen, you'd have Ewan McGregor and Robert Carlyle having roles in this movie. Which is not a bad thing, because they're great actors and Trainspotting's a great movie, but again, it shows these filmmakers were really dead set on getting people who had only made one or two movies. Because Danny Boyle had only made that and Shallow Grave.
Mm-hmm.
David Fincher never actually made a movie.
Adam, how familiar are you with Danny Boyle's work, and do you think he would have worked as the director of Alien 4?
I only know a few of his pieces. I've enjoyed them all, and I don't have any good excuse that I haven't gone back to watch all of his oeuvre, except just time and laziness. I hear Sunshine is one that I must watch, especially because of everybody attached with that film that I'm a fan of. But I think he would have been a pretty damn good choice. And yeah, I do think he would have brought some actors along that he liked working with, and I would actually be really interested to see that. I think at that point of his career, I think it could have been good. I don't know if the issue would have been with him in the studio, because it seems like the screenwriter kind of had issues with whoever the director was going to be.
Yeah, and it should also be said, too, that while we talked to David Giller and Walter Hill last week, they pretty much stayed out of this because they didn't think Alien 4 was a good idea. They kind of came up with the concept of clones, and they just kind of left it to whoever was running this thing. And we'll get into the film, but if you're ever going to interject yourself into a franchise film, this would have been the one to do it with. The studio moved on to David Cronenberg, who said, while it would have been great to work with Sigourney Weaver and Winona Ryder, I don't even make sequels to my own films. What makes you think I'm going to make yours?
That's Cronenberg.
Yeah, the guy didn't come back for The Fly 2, so what the fuck?
And 90s Cronenberg, if you look at the films he was making, he was really trying to show, hey, I'm not just the body horror guy, people. He was doing some really challenging stuff, like Naked Lunch. That book was deemed unfilmable in the same way that Lord of the Rings was for the longest of time. He'd do like M. Butterfly. He did Crash the year before. Not the Crash you're thinking of. He made a movie where James Spader fucks a car.
They then went after a guy by the name of Peter Jackson, whose name seems to come up with every franchise we do. But he had literally no interest in taking on this particular franchise, because I don't think he agreed with how they did Alien 3 either. So he was out. Matt, they then went to a guy by the name of Terry Gilliam. I had done Brazil, but Terry Gilliam had a brilliant quote of this where he said he compared it to basically a Chevrolet assembly line. I'm not going to be a part of your assembly. Yep, that's Terry Gilliam for you.
It is, but that rationale is so funny because I see a lot of Gilliam in Genet's style.
Oh, yeah. Hold your thoughts on Genet. Yeah, we'll get to him here in a bit.
Yeah, once we get to him. But yeah, Terry Gilliam, he's been his own man ever since Monty Python broke up. And I think he had already gotten his sci-fi fill with 12 Monkeys and Brazil. So I don't know if he would have wanted to go back in that sandbox, especially with the restrictions they knowingly would have put on him.
Then he went to an interesting name. Another guy who only had a couple films to his name at this point, but he had gotten some pretty good heat behind him after The Usual Suspects had come out. A guy by the name of Bryan Singer. And it was his producer, Tom DeSanto, who said, you know what, they had this X-Men thing going on. Why don't you go to that instead? But Bryan Singer at the helm of an Alien film in the late 90s, we will see him at the helm of a Stephen King story, which we'll talk about in the next couple years. But Matt, Bryan Singer, Alien, not a good match.
Wow, someone actually told Bryan Singer no, and he listened to them? I am so shocked.
I know.
But yeah, again, it would have fallen in line because he had made one movie. Usual Suspects was it. It's just funny that if he says yes to that, I certainly don't think he would have gotten X-Men. They would have handed that off to somebody else. So I guess I should be thankful that he turned down Alien 4, considering what we got from X-Men.
They then went to a guy we've spoken about in the past, but would make his own dark science fiction film in the same year. A guy by the name of Paul W. Anderson.
This fucking guy.
Yeah, another one who just keeps fucking popping up. All right, so after all these directors fell through, the studio had seen a little movie by the name of Delicatessen. And the director of that is a guy by the name of Jean-Pierre Jeunet. Now, this guy, I like his work. I really do. I think Delicatessen is a good film. I remember really liking it. He did a movie after this called Amelie that is really fantastic as well. I think he does great work. One thing's for sure, I think they thought that, like I mentioned, the European audience was there and they knew that they could get a European crowd with him. But I also think he would have just given this a different look because all of his movies have a real distinctive look.
Well, yeah, that's why I said he reminds me so much of Terry Gilliam, especially City of Lost Children. That's very much could be in the same universe as Brazil. Because his films are all about blending sci-fi with a more fantasy element. There's some interesting stuff with technology and futuristic worlds. Like, City of Lost Children, I think, is one of those movies that, if you're a fan of movies like that 80s fantasy series we did, or if you like Del Toro's work, I think you would find a lot to like in City of Lost Children. It is spoken in French, but you can watch the subtitled version.
That's one that would be rife to get redone in a big way. Not that it has to be big, but there's something beautifully sweet about that movie, even though it's pretty low budget, it's foreign, but there's some, I don't know, that movie's got something about it.
A couple other people behind the scenes I want to make mention of. One, in order to get Jean-Pierre Jeunet on this film, he wanted to bring his own European crew, so he brought his special effects crew, and at the head of those effects...
Oh boy.
It's a guy by the name of Pitoff, who the three of us have talked about.
Happy anniversary, Catwoman.
Catwoman. 20th anniversary. He is the director of Catwoman and nothing else. And he's here in charge of the effects.
They also had to hire a translator because Jeunet did not speak English.
Well, yeah, I was going to get to that. So they brought Jeunet on, and why you would bring somebody who didn't know how to speak English in order to talk to these actors and actresses, I will never know. But they brought this cat on, and you can definitely tell in the delivery of these lines that these actors had no idea. They were not being directed on what to say and how to say it, which is a big reason why the guy who wrote this film kind of disowns it. The guy who wrote this, a guy by the name of Joss Whedon, a guy whose writing I have always respected. I don't respect his human relationships, but at this point, 20th Century Fox was really impressed with what he was doing with Buffy. And his producer on that, a gal by the name of Gail Berman, recommended him for this job, and he was a huge fan. He took this being a fan, but he had no idea really how to do this as far as how to bring Ripley back. So he went to Newt. They were going to do this with Newt as the lead protagonist. They kind of got halfway through that, and they were once again told, you know what? Ripley is the backbone of the series. You need to bring her in. And that's when everybody came up with this cloning mechanism to bring Ripley back. But Matt, Joss Whedon, Alien, it would seem to be a good match, right?
With hindsight, because you think of Firefly and Serenity.
Which he did as a result of his experience on this.
Yeah, it was kind of him saying, let me give this another crack. Mm-hmm. Hey, you see Joss Whedon attached to these big geek properties. He is a good writer, certainly. Knows his stuff. But why is it we're not talking about the stuff like Buffy and Serenity, things he's actually acclaimed for? We're talking about the stuff that he disowns or ghost-directed between this and Justice League.
We will get to the Avengers eventually, which he is pretty well renowned for. Adam, as a guy who doesn't really know Whedon's work, you saw that name. What were you expecting?
I think I've been pretty clear on my thoughts on Joss Whedon as a person. Look, I think Firefly is good. I think Serenity is not. I think he's very hit and miss. I think he's ridiculously overrated, and I think because he's a nerd, he's found a way to get himself into culture and be almost infallible. I do find him the Louis C.K. of screenwriters in the way that he's just an utter douche. And I think some of the lines in this film are things that he would say to people in person, and I need to divorce that, but I find it hard knowing what he's and how he's treated people. Some of the lines that come out of people's mouth, I'm like, dude, I could see him saying this to this actress, this actress, this actress. I got a problem with Whedon, just period.
Well, a couple things on that. One, if you watch Buffy, there are so many layers to those characters, and it is a very, very involved show that you really, really care about those characters during the course of that show. I think it's
great.
Yeah, his writing in that is really fantastic. You can really tell when he has an episode as opposed to anybody else because his writing is so sharp on that. I thought it was a good choice. The issues, though, came in the translation of the script because he turned in a draft where, again, 20th Century Fox, they slashed a lot of the budget on this and a bunch of his ideas were left out. But the translation is really lost because Whedon really had an issue with how Jeunet handled the material. He said everybody was saying things that he had written, but not with the same emphasis on how he had written it. And that is an issue that I will talk about because I did read the script before we started this podcast, and there are major differences. And I think that Lost in Translation is really felt here. And I really do think that if you had Danny Boyle here, I think you could have had a really propulsive, really fun alien film. And as it is, we're not going to get that as a result of how this material was treated.
You never know. With studio yes men who were determined to get this movie made, damned quality, I don't know if just a director change would have changed the finished product. But I will say, this movie does read like when Guillermo del Toro started making English films. It feels like a script that was written in a foreign language, that was translated to English, retranslated again, and then delivered differently. It's like that telephone game where you say something to the person directly across from you, and it has to make its way across the line, and somewhere it gets lost in translation and screwed up.
Yeah, it's also interesting to note that this is the only Alien film where there's only one credited screenwriter. Usually there are a ton of people in the opening credits, so the fact that he is the one credited screenwriter is interesting to me.
Well, and I think it's funny that for the longest time he was just like, oh, they did this, and once the script finally came out and people were like, dude, these were your words, then it turned into, they just fucked up the tone. And yeah, that's a part of it, but this is still like, this is your script. Like, they literally did shoot what you wrote.
But the emphasis is different. That's the thing. If you have a director at the helm, he's the one who sets the mood. And his scripts are very defined by how it's delivered. And that is really lost. And Janae has, in recent years, come back against Whedon. He said that he thought that, yeah, Whedon would have made a film that people would have loved. You know why? Because Whedon makes movies for morons. That's his exact quote. So
stay tuned for Avengers.
The Frenchman coming through with his anti-American bias.
Choc le bleu.
And we're going to see a lot of that in this movie.
This sounds like a movie that Sigourney Weaver had a lot of pull on. She's back as a producer. She really endorsed Janae when he came on board. And it sounds like she had a lot of say in how this character was going to be portrayed again.
Big time. She wasn't even going to come back. In fact, they were, even at this stage, they were working on Alien vs. Predator. And she was like, yeah, I don't want any part of that.
Smart decision, for the record.
She did read the script. She really liked it. And she did sign on to come back. You know, it's funny. When she did Aliens, let's not forget, she didn't want to come back for that either. They attached a $1 million price tag to her, and she said, okay, I'm back. Last week, she had $4 million to come back. Boys, this time, she is back making $11 million, which, goddamn, is a huge price tag. Not only just for a woman, but for an actor in general back in the late 90s.
She was commanding, like, what Schwarzenegger would get for something.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I do see her influence here, big time. The look of her was different at the time, but she was the one who endorsed more of this sleek look. If you notice, her outfit is very much in the same tone and color as the aliens themselves, and I think that was a lot of her influence. I think she likes to challenge herself. I don't think she would have come back unless she felt there was a challenge here. And I do think that her being a clone and her being iffy on what side she's on was really fun for her to work with. Just in reading interviews with her and seeing interviews with her with this movie in mind, I do see what she's trying to do with it. And she did say that she wasn't going to do it, and then they literally backed up a truck full of money at her house. She said, okay, I'm in.
I love that quote, that she's honest enough to be like, they backed up a dump truck full of money, so I went ahead and did it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the Michael Caine thing of, I've never seen Jaws the Revenge, but yes. I did see the house it bought me.
I saw the house that it bought. We open up 200 years after the end of Alien 3 with a distorted shot of an alien as credits appear on screen. Now, this was much different in the director's cut. If you watch the director's cut, or not the director's cut, it should be said it's the editor's cut. This opens up with something that looks like an alien, but when it pulls back, it's actually a bug that's in the midst of a ship. And again, we're like, okay, we're trying to get way too fancy here for an alien film.
Just you explaining that to me, I feel like I lost brain cells. That is such a pretentious with a capital P.
Oh, my God. So we're in a research facility where doors open, and we have a shot of two guards chewing gum at the exact same pace. And according to Janae on the commentary, this was done as a kind of a jab at American soldiers. So right away, this guy's fucking emphasis is way off. We're going to take a jab at these soldiers. And he right away made the decision to make this into a dark comedy instead of an elegant horror film or propulsive film or hell, even last week, that movie, as much as we derided it, had something to say. Here, we're just going to get a black comedy, and it starts off here. So we're getting that familiar alien theme as Ripley herself, Sigourney Weaver's voice, rehashes the new quote, and her clone is being looked at and messed with by scientists, and an alien chestburster is pulled out by Charles Lee Ray himself, Brad Dourif. One thing I will give this movie, guys, is the cast is pretty stacked.
Oh, this is a who's who of great character actors. More so than Alien 3. These are a lot of people that... I'll say this for the movie. Unlike Alien 3, these characters are very distinct. Except because this is a Joss Whedon film, everybody has at least one snarky line. To your point about this being a black comedy and how it's in the opening scene, if you also notice, they're holding their guns so that if they fired, they would shoot each other simultaneously. The movie is not subtle by openly criticizing the military-industrial complex of America. This movie is all about how military that values the bottom line and commerce over intellect and science will be detrimental to the human race. Honestly, I'm okay with that because the Weyland-Yutani Company, even though they're not 100% involved, they've been moronic throughout these movies to vast degrees, especially in the last one. So this is nothing new, and I think it's also telling that this movie takes place 200 years later, and almost nothing has changed. I do think he's saying something with
it. Yeah, when you talk about it being a dark comedy and how you're going to do that, that's when I do think you got a director and screenwriter on the same page, because I think what's put together complements that fact. When we go into it, and it's amazing thinking of the time frame that this was done, because looking up the other films that were done around this time and cloning and it's amazing how much they all kind of fell in line. And something that came along the same time as this film, one of my favorites, you know what it was when you talk about DNA and cloning and gene?
Oh,
Gattaca.
Gattaca.
Big one. Gattaca, oh, same year. Movie. And I'm like, wow, it's amazing just to think of when you talk about literally genomes and DNA and everything else. I'm like, it's just mind-bending that everything seems to happen together. And this year was a lot of that.
I mean, swap out xenomorphs for mosquitoes, and I would half expect Mr. DNA to be giving some of this information.
Right from Joe's apartment.
Oh, and, speaking of props and background stuff, did they run out of glue to use on Brad Dourif's ponytail and just use duct tape? That thing is so unnecessary.
So get him in, Brad Dourif. He asks if they can keep the clone alive, as he's told the host is doing well. We then cut to an overhead shot of Weaver's Ripley waking up and emerging out of some kind of webbing. This film, as directed, is very saturated and stylized, very independent film oriented. But I will say, I do like the look of this film. Janae brought in Darius Kanji, who was his DP for a while. And Kanji has a really interesting way of coloring the film where he takes the actual film itself and he takes the color out and he saturates it with silver and black. And you definitely get that monochromatic feel here.
I think for the majority of it, I think the look is done really well. I think most of the shots are done really well. There's some that are abhorrent and abysmal, and a lot of it is shaky cam, cutty action-y. But when you have something like this here, which I in my notes is the rebirth of Ripley, and to me, I think this scene right here is what sold Sigourney Weaver on it, because I think this is what she wanted. I think it's done really well. I think it's pretty important. I think it kind of sets a tone, not just a color tone, but pretty much for what's going on. And I think this shows Ripley died. This is a birth of a completely different Ripley. And we've talked about Sigourney wanting this and wanting this and wanting this and kind of fighting since the 70s for it. And decades later, I think she's getting what she wants out of this character.
Well, to me, Ripley's been dead since the last scene of Aliens. So I've had a movie plus to mourn, and now I'm on the stage of acceptance. I like that the movie just throws you in. The heavy lifting has already happened, and she's about to be birthed properly after multiple failed attempts, as we'll find out. But I think the visual aesthetic of this movie works really well because I don't think it dates the movie in the same way that the cinematography dates Alien 3 in a lot of ways, and even Aliens to a certain degree, mostly because of that blue tint you always associate with 80s James Cameron. You mentioned how everything's all connected. Kanji was also David Fincher's cinematographer on Seven. And speaking of Danny Boyle, he was the DP on the beach.
Yep. Gettyman is examining Ripley, number 8, as Matt just outlined, so they had 7 failed attempts, and says that she's in excellent health. Her scar tissue has rescinded, and she's told that she's going to make them proud as she grabs Gettyman and chokes him out. She's shot at and releases him. So let's talk about Miss $11 million herself, Sigourney Weaver, in this role. Like I said, I do think she's took this on as a challenge. I do like that sometimes she's smiling at the aliens being out later on in the film, and sometimes she mourns when aliens are dead in here, but she's also along with the ride here. Matt, is it too big of an gimme to ask us to believe that she has been cloned and they took her DNA from that prison planet that was on ice and she's made here.
Only in the sense that they got something that dropped into molten magma to reharden to the point of freezing. That's the only bit of a stretch.
No, what I got is they took it from Charles Dance freezer on that prison planet. Oh. They didn't take it from the molten lava. They took it from the blood that he took from her.
Okay, that doesn't bother me because we've seen that the team that shows up with Bishop, the end of Alien 3, they have like hazmat suits and equipment.
Yeah.
So I can buy they scoured the area and then nuked the facility to cover up their tracks. As far as Weaver's performance goes, I can't believe I'm going to be the person to defend this. I think she is very committed, and I think she's the right kind of, I don't want to say camp, because I think she's playing it, like, she's not looking at it from that level, but there are moments that could have gone disastrously wrong, and I think she knows just enough when to pull back. Do I think Janae matches her in lockstep on that? Not always, but one of the things I really like about this movie from a story perspective, and I hate bringing characters back from the dead. Hate it. I think it's one of the laziest tropes we have in stories. The reason I hate it is because a lot of movies, they will resurrect somebody and they just move on with the story. To use an example that we talked about, Pirates of the Caribbean, when they bring Jack Sparrow back. I know he's not dead, but for storytelling purposes, he died. They bring him back and then it's never talked about again. The movie just keeps going. I like that they kind of took the monkey's paw element with bringing her back because it's the, yes, you can. But the cost for Ripley, even though this is not Ripley in purest form, is they took away her womanhood in a lot of ways. They removed her reproductive system. But because she's not 100% human or 100% alien, they instill her with free choice, which she never really had in the previous movies. The humans this time are not really the best of humanity. And the aliens, at least the ones that we see, are not mindless monsters. These are ones that have been experimented on and specifically bred for weaponization. So she has sympathy for the aliens, but a lot of resentment for the humans, because there's very few characters in this movie that are humans that don't try to kill her at some point. So she has every reason to just do the ultimate nihilistic thing of fuck humanity, but she subscribes to Joss Whedon's philosophy, and this permeates through a lot of his work, about, yes, humanity sucks, humanity is flawed. In all likelihood, we will blow ourselves up, but we owe it to ourselves to try to persevere and save what we can. Ultron's last scene in Age of Ultron, Vision emphatically says that, and that's plenty of other movies. So I like that from a story perspective, there's more here than I think what this movie is often accused of being just dumb and silly and campy. I think there is some thematic stuff that I really like. I don't think I'm reading too much and bringing those up.
To Matt's point, she's not playing it campy, but she's playing it different. I love that she is saying, I can play this different. I am not playing Ellen Ripley. She's not. She's playing Ripley 8 or whatever you want to call it. And she does it so well. I think she's bringing nuances. I think she's bringing some things that we're going to discuss as we get through this. But I think she is fucking fantastic in her choices and methodology and the way she's doing it. She is as a sexual object for part of it in the way of the way she's slinking around and doing things as much as the xenomorphs are in the first two films. There's just something electric about her performance, including the way that she moves, her movements with her head, her eyes, her movements with her mouth when she's teasing at something. She's phenomenal in this one. And I liked her in the last one, but I think she's really upping to a new level here.
And the way she plays basketball.
I swear to God, Patoff directed that scene.
We'll get there.
She does it in Avatar, too.
They're testing Ripley's knowledge of fruit, as Gediman says that she's operating on complete adult capacity, as well as holding memories that help her strength, which, you know what, that's another big gimme you got to give it. So, as you guys have mentioned, they've taken away her humanity, but they have not taken away her memories. Matt, is that too much to ask?
No, because I think that was an intentional, I guess you'd call it an intentional blueprint design by this corporation to have some sway over her, to have her think that she's human or considerably more human than alien. So it's kind of like this built-in failsafe that they have. But I also like that when she gives her answers, she's not 100% wrong. She says fruit, which is correct, but specifically it's a cherry, I think. So I like that she's intelligent enough to answer correctly, but they don't bust her chops for being overly specific.
I think it's important because it still distinguishes who she is, but she's separated from them. the humanity of who she was is kind of gone. And I think if the memories were completely removed, you know what you would have had? You would have had her coming across a computer of video diaries, and we would have had a montage of her watching herself and learning how everything else came to be. That's what they would have done.
God.
Jesus.
This movie has a challenge from a writing standpoint right at the beginning, at the foundation. If you look at the previous three movies, they follow the three types of portrayals of women in almost every form of storytelling. There's the maiden, alien, aliens, the mother, alien three, the widow slash the crone. What do you do in the fourth movie? So they're doing a lot of stuff here. Physically, this is the most sexualized Ripley has ever been.
Oh, big time.
Especially because they put her in what Carrie Ann Moss will be wearing in The Matrix 2 years later. But I also think that's intentional to play up the promiscuousness of a clone, you know, in the same way that they're weaponizing aliens. You know, this is kind of like using hot women for the Decepticons in Transformers 2 to wipe out humanity.
And you know what I will say? I want to be really harsh on a lot of directorial decisions in this movie, but I think the decision to give Ripley the layers that they do, as well as kind of lightening the tone, is a welcome one, because Matt, you'll be one who endorses this more than anybody. Last week's movie was so goddamn grim that you had to take it in a different direction, didn't you?
Well, certainly anything else would have looked like duck soup in tone compared to Alien 3. So I think that's why a lot of people, I mean, look, this movie is not without its faults, as we'll get to. But I think one of the reasons why people were so harsh on it was because it's such a tonal, not quite a 180, but it's almost a 90 degree change from what Alien 3 had established.
So we have General Perez, a.k.a. Dan Hedayas, fresh from the Tortellis and... And, of course, he was in Blood Simple, too, which is probably what Janae saw him in.
Well, Usual Suspects, speaking of Bryan Singer.
Oh, he was in Usual Suspects. I always forget that. General Perez says that they are thinking termination and says that he's not interested in Ripley taking up her old hobbies of elimination. We then get the introduction of the breath scanner, as General Perez says if she looks at him funny one time, he's eliminating her. He then asks when she's going to start producing, and he's told weeks at the latest, and we are shown our first fully grown alien. You know, I'll say this much about the design work. At least they got the slime right here with these aliens, but the acid blood is just way too milky, way too thick. I like the sleekness of it because of what Kanji has done with the filter, but I don't know how I feel about these aliens. Adam, are you enjoying what they did to the aliens here?
Are we just talking the regular Xenos at this point?
Correct, yes.
Is that all we've seen? It's amazing that a movie that's known for its underwater scene later on is shadowed here, because it looks like somebody is nonstop pouring buckets of water over the head of these xenomorphs. They're dripping nonstop, and it's so viscous that it's just, I don't know why. They're not in an environment where that would matter. They look a little off. I know you want to change them a little bit, but they're, it's like the song. I don't know. I'm a little bit off today. They look okay. But even the inner mouth is a little different. I can't stand when they spit acid. Yeah. I don't need a Hawk Tua version of a xenomorph. I really don't. Sorry, I just dated this podcast. But it bugs me when they do that. They're off a little bit. This movie really throws the gestation period and everything else completely out of whack.
I guess these pods that they're kept prisoner in have the temperate climate of the Amazon rainforest, and that explains why they're dripping from humidity. And also the acid blood, it looks like vegetable oil.
Yeah.
Every time you see it, because it's so thick and gross looking. But you also don't buy this is the same stuff that can melt the floor, even though we see that happen. I think the design work is fine. They look good, for the most part. To your point about the gestation process, my theory on that is because they're genetically manipulated, they found a way to enhance it. Sort of like the raptors in Jurassic Park.
Yeah, and it doesn't bug me as the movie goes on. The first time I see it, and I think we've mentioned it every film after the first one, so maybe the non-continuity of gestation is just one of the things in the franchise.
Ripley is being told what a fork is, and she just says, fuck, and she asks how they made her. Gediman says that they used blood samples from where she died, and they cloned her. She asks if the queen grows, and he says, rapidly. She then says that everyone in Weyland-Yutani will die. She's told things have changed since her time. And she just responds with, I doubt that. And again, they are all going to die. Ripley is told that the vaccines they can make from her will be staggering. And she responds with, they can't teach the alien tricks, which I thought was a great line, actually. I like her delivery of these lines.
Oh, I love how jaded she is playing this.
And yes.
She's sardonic and sarcastic, because a lot of times this kind of stuff she's not Ryan Reynolds in it. I think she plays it just right. Parts of it almost border on deadpan, which makes it actually funnier within the context, which is like, you're all going to die.
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, because it's clear, even in her deliveries, look, I dealt with these 200 years ago. I dealt with these 57 years before that. I dealt with these however many weeks before that. You know what? I'm tired of people not listening to the smart girl. You're all going to die. Fuck you. Mm-hmm. It's great.
We cut to some ships flying as well as an arcade game, which I thought was an interesting cut. But let's get to the ships flying. Let's get to the ships and the model work here. Now, this was pretty much the last hurrah of model work before digital effects started taking over. And you know what? We can make fun of Pitoff for his directing style and what he did 7 years later with Catwoman, but his effects work is marvelous. I love the model work here. I love the design of these ships. I like when we see them. And again, I think a lot of that has to do with the photography and what they've done with the filter. Adam, as somebody who is a huge proponent of model work, how do you feel the ships are here?
I think they've done really well. I like the way that the models not only look, but the way they're shot, the way that they seem to move through. I think they're a little more kinetic than some of the models we got even in the first two, and absolutely adored those. But I think this type of pace, they do a good job. It's hard for me to not look at the Betty and think of Serenity. It's just really hard to disassociate that. For Joss to say, oh, I didn't realize I did that with Firefly, that I ripped this off. Yeah, you did. it's all right there. To the point that you got people walking around in brown coats in this film.
Yes.
I think that does a really good job. You would think that it would take me out because there are some pretty damn effects in this film that do end up getting shot shoddily. But these look good.
Yeah, but you're starting to see the transition, sort of the last...
Yeah.
It's almost like the Ripley clone we see kill me when it comes to switching from practical to computer effects. Because 2 years after this, you'll get Star Trek Insurrection, where they almost went entirely CG. So this is the last of a dying era that was about to be euthanized.
Yeah, and they were really taking over, too, because don't forget, earlier this year, they had the Lost World as well. So digital effects were taking over. We are then introduced to some of the people we will be spending this next hour and 40 minutes or so with. So let's go over some of these people. We have Christy, a dude with dreads, played by Gary Dorden, who would go on to a lot of CSI work in the show CSI.
Yeah, he's and still getting residuals from that show.
Yeah, we have Hiller, played by Kim Flowers, Vryce, played by Dominique Pannone, a Jean-Pierre Genet mainstay, Elgin, played by Michael Wincott, and Johnner, played by Hellboy himself, Ron Perlman, just to name a few. I, of course, will get to the robot in this movie later, because I feel like she deserves her own shrine. But let's talk about this band of people we are introduced to here. We all really didn't like the anonymous nature of last week's band of misfits. How do we feel about these guys and girls that you would think they're here for fodder, but a lot of them live?
Oh, this is the blueprint for Firefly in a nutshell. Joss Whedon's Space Pirates, it's almost in lockstep. In fact, some of the character archetypes are pretty similar. But I think they're not up to the standard of Aliens, but that's a hard bar to pass. But I think a lot of it is, I think these actors all have screen presence, which really helps. What I will accuse it of, though, that I did not accuse Aliens of, they are pretty one-note. And the one I like the most doesn't last the whole movie.
Don't tell me you like Wincott in this.
Oh, I love Michael Wincott.
I fucking hate him in this movie.
He's got one of the great audio voices ever.
Yeah, but he sucks in this. I do not like
he's great.
Wow. Adam, how do you feel about this band of misfits?
I think you're trying to do that Space Marines without making them as likable, so I think you're mixing two and three. Yeah, I think they're fine. It's always great to see Beast from Beauty and the Beast here. Michael Wincott is... Oh, never mind. I can't do it. My voice is shot. But Michael Wincott, I can't see him without thinking of the Crow. That is always going to be my first and foremost thought.
I think of Prince of Thieves.
I think of Strange Days. So,
wow, we all get...
Yeah.
Well, it was also Prince of Thieves, and then he played the same role in The Three Musketeers, but he's not Goofy.
All great movies. So I like the choices of who they got for everybody. Gary Dorden's, I don't know, he stands out a little bit, is just not fitting in the crew. Maybe it's because I know how his personal life took a turn. But I like it. It's not overblown. We got so many of the Space Marines that you had to get the scene that chopped it down to a reasonable level. So I like pretty much everybody that we have going on here. They are distinguishable from one another, so that's helpful. They're very one note, but they're at least quite different.
We are then introduced to Call, played by my former future wife, Miss Winona Ryder. Now, Ryder accepted this role without reading the script because she was a huge fan of this franchise. She gets to be a plot device here who's revealed to be the android later on. All right, I'm going to say something that will probably make sure that I never, ever have a good conversation with this woman. I hate her in this. I really don't like her. First of all, she comes in to kill Ripley later on. Winona Ryder is 5'3", Sigourney Weaver is 6 foot. So already we have that distinction of she doesn't really work in that way. She has this pixie haircut that we're supposed to buy as she's this robot. I like the fact that we're going with the ABCs here of the androids. We had Ash and Alien. We had Bishop and Aliens. And now we have Call. So the ABCs. I like that they're doing that, but I don't like Winona Ryder in this role as much as I love Winona Ryder. I love you. How do we feel about Call in this, Matt?
Well, the inclusion of a android or a synthetic feels like a studio mandate where it's like, oh, we can't make an alien movie without Sigourney Weaver, or we can't have an alien movie without a robot. And me saying Winona Ryder is the worst actress in this movie, I could say that about almost every movie she's ever been in. The problem with Winona Ryder that I have with her as an actress is that too often she is put alongside actors that are just out of her depth. Gary Oldman in Dracula, at circles around her. Daniel Day-Lewis in The Crucible, at circles around her. Even Edward Scissorhands, I think she's fine.
I was just about ready to say that. I think Johnny Depp acts circles around her in Edward Scissorhands, although she's pretty good in that, I thought.
I like her in Beetlejuice. I have not seen Stranger Things, but I just think she's the weak link in too many of her movies, and this one, she's not believable as an android whatsoever. When that reveal happens, I'm like, there were no breadcrumbs for you to have any suspicion of that.
And that is a very Joss Whedon-type reveal when we do see that. Don't forget, too, that she was riding that wave of stardom here because she gets top billing right next to Weaver above the credits. So she was right at the height right before it really took the skids and she became very disengaged with Hollywood. So it was a get to get her. I understand why you go after her. I just don't understand why you put her in this role.
I think she's okay, but I think this was a time of her life where I think this is when a lot of the troubles kind of started. But the years before this, I mean, yeah, you're a couple years removed from Reality Bites, but she was a big part of Little Women. She was a big part of Boys. I mean, she kind of disappears for a little bit after this. If you want to see a good performance, watch Sex and Death 101. Good film.
It is a good
series. But she's okay. She comes across as robotic. I think part of that's intentional. There's a scene that I love throughout this film, but other than that, I think she comes across like an also-ran, but maybe that's because everybody else is given these lines and speech throughout the film, and she's not given much to do other than process lines like a computer.
And complain.
Yeah.
I feel about her the way Garrett feels about the kids in Jurassic Park, where it's like, I want a xenomorph to just rip her in half. The last thing we need is her publicist coming after us.
I love her.
I think, speaking of Buffy, Sarah Michelle Gellar should have played this part.
Oh my gosh, she would have ruled in this. You know who they wanted for this, though? They really tried getting Angelina Jolie for this. And
girl interrupted.
I was just about to say, and then she turned them down, and it's very ironic that 2 years later, she would get the role that really made her in Girl Interrupted with Winona Ryder.
Well, I thought this would have been,
right after Gia, I think.
Yeah, you're right, after Gia. No, I was not going to say Tomb Raider. Oh, we got to get to video game movie soon.
Oh, we're going to have to do this one day.
Yeah, we will. Elgin sleazily hits on the pilot as the ship takes off.
This is when, and I'm rewatching it, and I started speaking of moving on, but this is when I started going Joss, Louis C.K., and I started putting it together because he's just like, I love watching a girl strapped in. And I'm just like, those are the lines where I'm like, that's just skeevy. And I just.
Adam, they're not in the script. This was added.
I'm not going with that. It's the words that come out of his mouth in all of his scripts.
Yeah, but this is not him. This is Janot adding stuff.
I call bullshit on that.
Read the damn script, yeah, dude.
There's too much precedent in a lot of his other movies.
Later on, we're going to get an overhead shot of him with this chick with her ass out. That is not him either. That is added. All he said in the script was, we have overhead shots of the rooms. He did not say that somebody's going to have their feet massaged with their ass hanging out in the room. Like, this is all added by a French fucking filmmaker who had no idea what he was making.
Well, first of all, that part I thought Tarantino stepped in and directed. I was like, good God.
So they are then scanned for weapons, which, of course, all of them have. General Perez gives the reason that he's concerned the crew members will be drunk and put a hole through the hull, and then tells Elgin about their cargo and military operation they've embarked on, as he gives Elgin this cube in a glass that turns into alcohol, which, again, not in the script. This was just added. And if you listen to Janot in the commentary, he says, yeah, I added it because it's fucking stupid and I thought it would look fun. This is actually a great setup, though, because this whole thing of General Perez telling Elgin, yeah, I was scared you guys would shoot a hole in this ship. That happens later, and I thought this was a brilliant setup for that.
Well, this is no different than the CIA hiring mercenaries to assist them on Black Ops missions. I also like the mystery of, why are they giving them bodies? Yep. Like, they mention cargo when you see the body in cryosleep, but they don't outright tell you what it is. They show you, which I always praise in screenwriting.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, we don't understand exactly why and the secrecy behind it and that kind of stuff. And I like that that part is still kept in the dark a little bit.
Yeah, let's not forget, these aren't good people. None of these are good people because they are human trafficking here.
Yeah, they're literally space pirates.
Yes, exactly.
They've murdered, they've pillaged. I'm pretty sure some of them have committed rape.
Mm-hmm. They're moving the bodies in pods as they're told the facilities are off limits to civilians. We see them examining the alien eggs up close, and then we cut to the basketball scene that Matt is convinced was directed by Pitoff.
Like I said, once is a coincidence, twice is a pattern.
You know what, though? This was something that Weaver pushed for, because as Adam mentioned, this was in Avatar as well. She does love basketball, and she did think, okay, what's a good way to have Ripley show her new powers? Oh, she plays basketball. But it should be said, when she sinks this shot behind her back, that was real. They did not drop a ball from the top. She got it in six takes. Janelle was like, I'll give you a shot to do this, but I know I will have to cut around it. And when you see Ron Perlman after she sinks it, they had to cut away pretty quick because he was genuinely like, holy shit, she made it. Which, if you watch the behind the scenes, is really fun. But my God, playing basketball to show your powers, that's an interesting way of doing that.
Yeah, at least they don't do a full game.
Yeah,
it's, you know,
we see like, 7 years
like,
later.
Yeah, it's not Catwoman where they literally play a full quarter, basically, or at least that's what it felt like. Here, she's just doing some tricks with the ball, and Ron Perlman's being sleazy at her because, yep, it's a Joss Whedon production. But yeah, this doesn't bother me. This is not the Catwoman scene. This is not the park fight in Daredevil, to use that comparison. I am perfectly okay with this sequence.
Look, and she's hamming it up. The way that her body line, she is just having fun with the way she's playing this character, and I think it really shines through her performance.
Definitely. She's playing keep away, and then she catches the ball in midair and uses it as a weapon, which I thought was awesome. And then we see close-up of the blood as she wipes it from her nose, and it starts burning through the hole, which was something we haven't seen in the last couple films, which I thought was fun. We have more shots of the aliens in captivity, and I God damn, you talk about weird takes. How about this shot of Duruf just matching facial expressions with the alien through the glass?
All right, this scene has been ruined for me because I watched a YouTube clip where they synced this with Shania Twain.
Oh, God.
And I can now no longer watch the scene without laughing. But this kind of ties into the pervy sexuality that Alien has always had. So in its own way, this doesn't feel that far out of left field.
I was surprised how much of this film I remembered, because I've seen this movie a number of times over the years, but it's been, I think when I got the set, I watched both versions of it, but it's been a long time since I've seen it. And it was amazing how much of this came back right away. And this is one of those. I'm like, yep, I remember the face movements. Oh, I remember this. Oh, I remember that. There's things in this movie that just stick with you, like a good set of ribs. It's just it's sticking around.
Oh, I want ribs so bad now. So the Edelman turns on the steam, and this just pisses the alien off. Paul is using boxing gloves to pick up a cup and is told to just walk outside. We then cut to Carl walking in as she sprays the scanner, and this is passed as General Perez. She walks up to Ripley, who asks if she's going to kill her, and then she asks, why are they keeping me alive when they took the alien out of me? Carl asks where the alien is, and Ripley just says that they're curious because she is the latest thing. Man, the fucking sexual overtones in this scene alone. This is not bisexuality. This is flat out lesbian here.
Oh, yeah. This is two scenes away from being bound.
It should also be said this was very taboo around this time, but this was also the same year, I believe, Adam, this was the same year Ellen came out, right? Or do I have that wrong?
I don't know if it was 97.
I think this was the same year.
It was around there. But it was very much Year of Woman time. There was a lot of other women that were coming out if it wasn't that. I'm going to say, I'd love these two together in this scene. When she goes in there, this conversation between them, just the back and forth, I think it's pretty great. This is what I like Winona in this movie. These two going back and forth. And again, Sigourney's just, she is relishing it. She is chewing up scenery, actors, everything around her in the way that she's playing it, but she's doing it convincingly. And this is another scene where I'm like, man, I'm having fun watching them together.
I still find this to be very one-sided. I think she's doing all the heavy lifting, not just because she looks like she's been hitting the gym in between productions.
Ripley says that she doesn't want the pain or the nightmare to stop, which I thought was an interesting line. When Call asks who she is, Ripley responds with Ellen Ripley. When Call challenges her on it, Ripley asks who she is. Call responds with the fact that they brought her out of a lab so she could give birth to an alien. Ripley then tells Call that they can't stop the alien as it is inevitable, and then she says that they'll never get out alive as she tells Call to get out of there. And Adam, I'm with you. This scene is pretty glorious between these two.
It's a lot of heavy exposition. It's a lot of delivering what you're going to get for the rest of the film. And it is literally cliff notes for those that have not been able to follow for the first 30 minutes of this film. But it does a good job, I think, for me at least.
Call walks out and is then taken in by law officials. The military walk in on the gang and they tell them that they brought a military weapon on board the ship. We then see a firefight break out as one officer is taken out by a ricocheted bullet. God, these ricochets. Meanwhile, we see two aliens collude with one another right before getting in a fight and taking one out, where lots of yellow blood creates a hole where they get out. So I never saw them being this cunning, but here we are.
Okay. The ability of these xenomorphs to suddenly decide that they're going to work together like they're a Colonial Marine set is one heck of a decision, because the teamwork and effort that they work into working together are extraordinary, to say the least.
This movie reminds me a lot of another sequel we've talked about. This is the Jurassic Park 3 of alien movies, where it's 90 plus minutes of people running from aliens and trying to escape. And the xenomorphs in this are almost the intellectual successor to raptors, where they work together and can set traps and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, there's some precedent for that in Aliens, to be sure. It involves some water effects. Hell, this might be the precursor to Deep Blue Sea, if we found out that they gave the xenomorphs the drugs to make them smarter.
You know what, Matt? I thought of Deep Blue Sea a lot when they get on that ladder later.
Well, once they go down hull and they have to swim, I half expected them to run into LL Cool J.
Faster than a shark fin. So, Get a Man tries steaming them out again, but they're not there this time. He is then grabbed and brought down by the alien, which I thought this was the death of him, but stay tuned. Call then says that an alien species is being breeded as an alarm is going off. We didn't see an alien turn the steam on, which was different. As Matt said, they are smarter now because they've been grown in a lab. And the fact that the alien is out is causing Ripley to smile and the soldiers to reconvene, which I thought was a great choice to kind of show her smiling when they get out. Again, she's really conflicted here, and I think Weaver's playing it really well.
She's also like, I told you so.
Exactly.
I've had three movies where nobody believed me.
Yeah.
And she knows, like, oh, now they're going to come to me saying, help us. And I'm going to wait to tell them to go F themselves.
An evacuation is ordered as Vrees shoots at an alien. Ripley cuts herself so she can burn her way out as acid blood falls on Vrees. Love that they brought this back, as I mentioned. He's firing away as more anonymous dudes are taken out. Pods are launched and blown up as Perez is then taken out. So no more of Dan Hedaya and his hairy back.
Okay.
This.
What the
Yeah, this was weird.
Of the things I remember, this gave me just, I don't know if nightmares, I was a little too old for that, but remembering this head getting punctured and him pulling out a part of his brain to look at it before he died. Oh, man, This is Hellraiser shit.
It is, but when they show him being cross-eyed, I was kind of taken out of the moment. Yeah,
well, it ties into the fact this movie's a dark comedy, because he has like a comedic reaction to when he looks at the brain and he gets all bug-eyed.
You know, speaking of other things that Ridley Scott worked on, it made me think of Hannibal, Matt, when, you know, was working on his brain. It was kind of the same thing. We then see Elgin fire a gun and then taken under by the aliens. I really did like this death, even if I hated this character. And it should be said, too, this is the last action we're going to get for quite a while. A lot of these people are taken out very quickly. I think they kind of blow their load a little early.
No, I'm actually okay with it. Yeah, I think that it started off with, you know, some decent stuff. And I think this movie actually goes along at a decent clip. I never felt we were cast heavy, and we just had a hell of a lot of deaths, and we got enough to still go through. But no, I'm good with the way it's going.
I find this movie moves at a pretty good clip, especially in contrast to the last one. I think your enjoyment of this movie depends on two things. Number one, if you prefer Aliens to Alien, I think you'll have a better time with this one, because it's more closely paced to Aliens than Alien. And if you're someone like me who hates Alien 3 because of numerous reasons, this one might be a little bit more your speed.
Here's my problem with that, and with this movie in general. I think All the other movies, yes, even the last one, had something to say. This movie has nothing to say, and we're just here going along with a junky science fiction film, which I never thought Alien was. And that's what kind of takes me out of this. Even if Weaver is giving it her all, I am not with it just because of what I have seen this franchise become, a franchise I was in love with.
Well, it's absolute freaking almost like Cinemax schlocky version of Aliens. I mean, you look at the cast that's in it and you're like, oof, okay. All of them play caricatures more than characters. You got Michael Winscott in a movie. I know what he's going to bring. So yeah, I can't disagree with you in that way. Like it is not the thoughtful, meaningful sci-fi for the most part that we got in, especially the first two films.
You're right. But I alluded to this earlier. I think the movie does have something on its mind. I don't think it's entirely brainless. But you're right that it's much more in line with stuff like Independence Day, you know, contemporary science fiction that was around that time. But also, after Alien 3, I was happy the pretense was removed. I will say that. And I would argue Aliens is, in a lot of ways, you know, people accuse that movie of being dumb. It's just so well made that that argument doesn't hold a lot of water. Look, I don't hate this movie, and that was the most shocking thing. When I thought I was going to detest this movie when I went back and watched it. But I'm with it for the most part. Is it schlocky? Absolutely. But remember, I'm the guy, I love Schwarzenegger. Look, there's some Seagal movies I like. I know, shocking. But I also love dumb science fiction. Sometimes I want something like Star Trek, which is a little bit more thought-provoking and intellectual, up until 2009, which I can't wait to talk about those in a couple years.
Stay tuned.
As I keep mentioning. But sometimes I want some fried pickles. And I think this is better made than the fucking AVP movies. I think this movie unfairly gets lumped in with those. I think that's a big disservice.
But going back to Aliens, though, I think Aliens had a little more to say. We talked about the Vietnam parallels. We talked about the fact that it was all about a 2.5-hour drive to get Ripley to have a family unit again. All of that, I think, worked with it. With this movie just has nothing along those lines. You know what else I thought a lot of, Matt? Especially since we saw a death of a guy getting frozen and torn apart. I thought of Jason X while watching this.
Yeah, I think it's kind of that level. But also, I like this movie kind of comparable to Jason X, where I had fun with it. But that franchise has less of an excuse because it didn't start out as high art. It started as a McDonald's hamburger. To my point of Jurassic Park 3, Jurassic Park, I accused that movie of, I have a lot of issues with it. So when the third one came around and just threw up their hands and said, let's have fun, I rode with it. And I'm having the same mentality.
The alien appears behind them as they move toward the door. We then see a shotgun emerge from the floor and take out the alien. And my favorite Winona Ryder delivered line is when she just looks and goes, what the fuck, as Ripley emerges from the floor. We have some infighting as the Misfits are told that there are 12 more aliens roaming around. And Ripley asks who she has to fuck to get off this ship. And that was a fucking groaner. I did not like that line at all.
Gee, I wonder who wrote this movie.
Well, it's not just that. It's just like the way she's delivering it. Whedon can write these lines, and if they're delivered fine, I think they work. But I don't think Weaver was too in tune with what was being written here.
Well, but then it keeps up. That's not even the joke. Then you also have Ron Perlman going, I can get you off. I can even get you off the ship. Like, really? You're going to triple down on an already groaner? Dude.
And then later on, they asked her, what did you do when we went through this last time? I died. Another groaner. I just
love that one.
I thought that was actually funny.
You guys are out of your fucking minds. Call warns that they'll turn on them in a second and they can't trust her, but everyone else outvotes Call and they all head out. Ripley gives Call an alien tongue, which I thought was funny, as Call says that killing the aliens is like killing her own kind. They open the door and see Vreese, who responds with, what were you expecting, Santa Claus?
Which is a direct line from City of Lost Children.
But you know what? This was not written this way. This was written as, what were you expecting, the Easter Bunny? But Dominic Pannone, God bless him, he could not deliver that line. And every time he said it, his English isn't that good. So every time he said it, he said Eastern Bunny. And so they could not get the cast to stop laughing at that. So they just changed it to Santa Claus, which is not delivered much better. More back and forth happens between the group. We learn that any sign of trouble and the ship will start autopiloting back to base, which is located on Earth. And then we hear Ron Perlman deliver the line, Earth, what a shithole.
I remember so many trailer lines for this.
Yeah, definitely. They then lead to where all the clones are. And this is a scene that, if you listen to the commentary, they can't stop gushing over Weaver and her performance here. Now, I really liked her performance in the first film. Loved the previous two performances, but I'll be this guy. I don't think the scene has any weight, and I don't think Weaver, as much as she's giving it her all, I just don't think the scene works in this movie.
This specific scene, I think, is only okay. And maybe it's just because, like, for me, it's been built up so long. Like, I know what Sigourney Weaver's wanted with the kids and all that kind of stuff throughout the film. So it's there. Maybe it's the other actors around and everything else. It just doesn't land like it should be able to. And maybe it's even the design of what's in these containers. It doesn't get all the way there. It's trying, you know what? But in a marathon, it's walking across the last 5 miles.
Yeah, I think part of the underlying issue is the fact that some of the failed clones don't look humanoid enough for us to have sympathy. So that aspect does feel a little bit manipulative, as is the fact that the score to this scene doesn't accentuate it either.
Oh my God, the fucking score to this movie. I'm so glad you brought that up. This composer sent in Tate to be the composer on this. And of course, Janae said, okay, I'll let you be the composer on this. This score is fucking awful. And this guy is just a terrible music composer. If you look at his resume, he's got some real groaners. This movie is not done well. I hate the music to this. It's the worst music of the entire franchise. Adam, I'm assuming you wanted him to score Aliens.
He said, I am never going to look back to you know what? Hey, I got one word for you. Petoff and his next movie. So you get to shut up. your score.
Yeah.
This is it's not good.
Ripley sets fire to the place and throws down the flamethrower as Carl punches this guy, which I thought was funny. We then cut to the ship orbiting Jupiter as they find this guy from Seven to wake up from cryosleep and say that he saw horrible things. Now, this guy was much more fleshed out in the Whedon script. They kind of narrowed it down to somebody who's just shouting, and you talk about somebody who overacts. Leland Orser, if you see him in Seven, he's been in so many other things. He really overacts, and man, all he does is just cry in pain this entire movie.
He's one of those guys where I know his face, and I've obviously seen him in other movies, but I couldn't pick him out of a lineup. But yeah, it's weird. The movie already has a ticking time bomb element with the ship being on the crash course for Earth, which this is the fourth movie in a row that involves either a self-destruct or we need to get away before something explodes. So I guess that's another aspect they can't get away from. I don't like that they're compounding it with this guy's got an alien inside of him, because there's no good reason to keep him alive. If he knew the detonation code or the override, maybe that'd be some good justification. But as it is, these characters are a lot smarter than that. They're a lot more ruthless than that. So it doesn't make any sense that they keep him alive as long as they do.
The only reason to keep him around is to have a chestburster that you know the audience came here to see. That's literally the only reason he's still around. And I forgot to mention earlier in the film, instead of mother, we have father here. So they inverted that as well.
Father? I wanted to throw my remote because I had forgotten that part of it. That 20 years later, that's still ridiculous.
I didn't mind that.
No, that's insulting. That's how stupid that is. No, you know what's clever? You know what? I hope he can make it uncle in the next film. That's how dumb calling it father is.
Jesus.
No, it'd be Holy Ghost with Ridley Scott's theostocrical bullshit.
Get your DP back over there. Make it a stepmother. You know, let's go down that route. This chest burst, it's clear that he's here just because we need to have that scene. And that's the only reason that he's here, as well as his performance. I swear that somewhere in the realm between 95 and 97, he got on a set and they filmed him once and they recreate that for every movie he's in, because he does the same crying, screaming, running around, whether it's here, whether it's Seven, every movie he's the exact same character.
Independence Day.
Yep.
He was also the villain in The Bone Collector. He's also in Daredevil.
Oy vey. We'll get to that.
You know, speaking of park scene, it's funny that a guy named Leland Orser plays Wesley in the universe that has a character named Leland Owsley.
Ripley says that he has one inside him, and then she tells him that there's a monster in his chest, and it's a real nasty one that's going to burst in a few hours. When he asks who Ripley is, she responds with, "I'm the monster's mother." They tell Vrace that he needs to lose the chair as they move around on the bottom of the ship, and they have to go through the kitchen to get to the other side, which means they have to swim through water.
Yeah, this is where the movie becomes the Poseidon Adventure.
I thought of that too, but you know what? The script actually has this defined much better. In the script, the reason why they have to go up, down, all around, and through this kitchen is because one of the soldiers accidentally shot the side of the ship, and 3/4 of the ship is shut down. So they have to do this. But Janae didn't want that. Janae just wanted the look of this scene, and he wanted to keep it in anyway. So we're not going to do that bit of a plot point. We're just going to go down and into this water, a scene that flat out traumatized Winona Ryder because she almost drowned when she was 12 years old.
Yeah, she has a hardcore phobia of water.
Yeah. And here she is on the first day having to go underwater with divers, the only thing to put the water to their mouths if they need air. This was a big part of the making ofs. I remember around this time, and Entertainment Tonight would play things up from this scene. I remember on the 2003 DVD release, there was a huge part of them in the making of about this scene. It was a terrible scene to shoot. They had to shoot this for like a month. And the water, of course, is going to, people started pissing in it. It started getting toxic. So they had to redo the water, everything else. I think it looks better than what I remembered. I remember the aliens looking a little too CGI. They don't. They look pretty decent. I like the way they look. I think this is much better than last week's CGI. But at the same time, I think this scene just goes on too long.
So where do I start? So, as far as the aliens themselves go, I'm not bothered by the CG or how they look. My problem is how they move. Given the physics of water and their physiology, they shouldn't be able to move this quickly in water, considering how sluggish the humans are. Their movement makes a lot more sense because of weight distribution. My other issue, though, is this scene just goes on for fucking ever. And they're holding their breath with the prowess of Aquaman. Half of these characters should have drowned.
Yes.
Before they reach the surface. This is one of the scenes where it's the line is because it's a movie.
Yeah, to Matt's point, this is a, was it Mission Impossible 5 with Tom Cruise underwater? Like, yeah, it is that like level of them holding their like breath.
Six or whatever he did.
Yep. I remember, Garrett, to your point, and Matt's, I remember this looking so much worse than it actually is when I watched it this time. Because I got to this and I'm like, here we go. And then I'm like, you know what? This actually doesn't look bad. Now, the CGI Xenos, yeah, they're not clean, but I think maybe because we've seen some worse cut and pace, especially last week, they don't take me out as much as I thought. I'm exactly in step with Matt that their movements do not make sense in the environment they're in. Maybe they looked a little bit different, but no, those tails don't have a fin. They don't have a web in their hand. They don't have anything that should make them move like this in water. Somebody came up with the idea, you know what would be cool? Put them in water. We haven't seen that. And I get it. You're taking aliens, you're taking the xenomorphs, putting them in water. It's terrifying. It's cool to think of and to write up. And yeah, this scene goes on probably twice as long as it needs to. Its conclusion is a weird finale of where this moves them into the next part of the story. Like, it's just weird, but it was so much better than I thought it was actually going to be, and from what I remembered.
Oh, yeah. I thought this was going to be the gymnastics scene from Lost World.
Oh, God. Yeah. Or the basketball scene?
Or the basketball scene. Yeah. Or the park scene. Yep.
We have Hiller being taken out while underwater, and then they swim up and see that they're amongst a nest of alien eggs. Which, you know what? I like this reveal. I like the fact that when they come up, here they are amongst alien eggs. I think that's terrifying. I thought that was I thought that was good.
I like the reveal. Someone call Admiral Akbar because everything in this movie is a trap. But these eggs do not act like the eggs we've seen throughout the entire course. And that just bugs me at this point. And the facehuggers don't either. And that also bugs me. I'm all for evolution. I think that is important when we're talking about xenomorphs because they're supposed to be this evolved thing. But these eggs don't act like what we've seen. They're smart eggs.
Yeah, they're smart eggs. That was a Janot decision. He wanted them to look even more slimy and more thick than they've been in the past. But you're right. They're not consistent. Although I will say I do like the way the face of huggers emerge and how they crawl out of the eggs. I think that's pretty cool. But other than that, this guy has no idea how to create terror and has no idea how to create dread. So he's just going to create a junky thing of what we've seen before.
This, I think, is cool. But to Adam's point, I am continually perplexed by what the life cycle of these fucking aliens are. It's sort of like time travel in Terminator where it's not consistent from movie to movie.
Christie fires some grenades which land inside the eggs. I thought this was a cool way of taking out these eggs. And then we see Call get shot as she falls in the water and the company man goes through the door and locks it. Christie is taken out while doing the heroic thing of taking off his vest and sacrificing himself. And I love this method that Perlman does of leaning back and shooting and taking out the spider and its web. I thought that was really cool.
This xenomorph dodging bullets on the ladder.
Like, yes. He's
freaking Agent Smith. It's like duking its head. Freaking
far. Yes. And then Perlman did say he loved doing it when he was doing it. And then he woke up the next day and was like, ow, my legs really hurt. Like, he could barely film the next day because he was so in pain from having to lean back in this fucking ladder.
Yeah, I guess bullet time got created 2 years earlier than initially publicized.
Exactly. We didn't get the very Joss Whedon type reveal of Call being the android of the film. And then Ripley tells Call to blow the ship or crash it before it reaches Earth. She just needs to give them time to get out first.
you also have, they're trying to do the Burke beat again, where, oh, the guy that's with the company turns out to be the villain. He leaves them all to die. But this kind of starts, Joss Whedon has a history. One of his tropes is killing off someone unexpected, except they're not actually dead. So on the one hand, it's like, oh, I bought it for a second, but then I saw Winona was top billed next to Sigourney Weaver, and I'm like, she's not dead.
Call sees that Ren is almost out of the Betty, and she orders all aliens on level one to go after him.
Sorry, that just made me laugh. She's like, all aliens, he's on level one.
Yeah.
Ripley's like, you got a mean streak. Now, I got to say, this, okay, to have Winona Ryder there, she's wounded while her and Ripley are having this scene together. To have Ripley inserting her fingers into Call with this fluid squirt. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah.
Literally, come on.
I mean, there's subtlety freaking it got left behind 200 years ago.
Yeah, this is the French aesthetic of inserting eroticism into this world that really didn't need it.
I would argue, though, it kind of does, because this franchise has always had an underlying sexuality to it.
It has. I'll agree with that. I mean, fuck. I mean, that's all we talked about when we talked about Giger, when we talked about Alien. But at the same time, Giger's not here, so they're really stretching to insert the eroticism into it.
And this one does not have the pervy biomechanical look
exactly
of the sets. But this goes away from that being a part of the aesthetic of the entire film to being like, I'm going to finger my sex doll.
Ripley says that she's finding a lot of things funny lately. She also says that she goes on living because she doesn't have much of a choice. Call says that she came here to kill Ripley and she cares about what happens to the crew. And Ripley responds, you mean you're programmed to be an asshole?
Perlman. You're the new asshole model?
Yeah, you're the new asshole model. Johnner loses his shit and threatens Call, and you just don't do that around Ripley. They then head towards the docks as she says that the queen is close and in pain. She's then pulled into the dock right in the center of the queen, where I'm guessing she has sex with it, because she said since the second film she wanted to have sex with the alien. And you know what? I do like the way it looks. I like when she's on this surface and she's just kind of sinking into it. I do think there's a real, I don't want to say eroticism to it, but there's a real elegance to this particular scene.
I feel like I'm watching some of the parts that I was not supposed to be watching of Flash Gordon, because there's some scenes of that are literally just like this. One, she also stretches out her arms and it's almost a Christ-like pose as she sinks into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think this is where you get your also kind of biosexual mechanical stuff is what's going on here. Like, it's not as overt, but it's really right there.
Oh, yeah, this is totally like the merging of two species. Like, this could be straight out of a Clive Barker book.
Oh, yeah.
Or, Adam, one of your H.R. Giger books from back in the day.
Yep. That shot of her there and that. And I got to say, that set of her with everything else. Because as it zooms in, as she's falling, you can feel like there are, at that point, possibly dozens of xenomorphs, or maybe not. Like, that feels like a piece of artwork.
Call on the crew, say, fuck it, and they just leave her. We see the ship is heading towards Earth. Ren reappears and takes Call hostage as we finally get the chestburster scene of an alien bursting through Larry. And then we have this weird shot of going not deep
just,
inside his
mouth. Not just Larry. Oh, yeah.
Well, sorry. Yeah.
Sorry.
We hear that now the alien queen is perfect. Really long shots of the queen as it gives birth to the baby. Some very creative effects. I do love how Gediman's still here, and he's here to comment on him just because of how great Brad Dourif's voice is. Just really weird set of scenes here that I never thought I would see in an alien film. And then we see something I also never thought I would see. We have this, they call it the newborn. Now, Matt, did you see the original concept of the newborn?
No. Was the design heavily changed?
Yes, big time. Because the original design had genitalia on it. Because Jeannot insisted on having genitalia being shown on this alien. And then they looked at it, and even this Frenchman looked at that and was like, yeah, that's too sexualized.
Yeah, even H.R. Giger's like, dude, that's too much.
Yeah. If you look on Wikipedia, it is there. It is fucking weird if you look at
it. Might have to turn my firewall off.
No. It just has a bunch of effects crew kind of looking at it, and it looks bizarre. I'm so glad they didn't go with that design. Adam, have you seen that?
I have, yeah. The whole that it's... I won't spoil it for anybody that hasn't seen it. Yeah, look it up. Make sure your kids are not in the room. Turn your safe search off. But yeah, it's a go. It's a choice.
It's both male and female genitalia on this one. It's bizarre.
So it's literally Hellraiser.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
It's a fucking Cenobite.
But so, I had forgotten, and I could not believe when it pans over and we get a womb attached to the alien queen.
Mm-hmm. So the newborn takes out the queen, which was something I never thought I would see. Like, this newborn is hatched, and then boom, you're going to take out the queen, which, I mean, we saw Weaver take it out in Aliens, but this was crazy to see. Although, I don't know how I feel about the design of this newborn. I like it in concept, but the eyes just kind of do something to me where I'm kind of taken out by it.
Can't stand it. I'll be straight up. I can't stand it. As soon as we get down into this pit, lair, womb, whatever you want to be, I think we got a lot of issues. One, I can't stand that we attached a womb to the queen. I got a problem with it. I have an issue with this newborn. As its life cycle, I guess it was fully inside that womb because it births and it's like, ta-da. I understood that they were like, look, people had a problem with, you know, the original xenomorph. Is it this? Is it that? You kind of, in that first one, have a vision of the skull inside the big black dick of the head. So they wanted to change something with it. And it blinks. It's like adding eyelids to Ewoks. Don't do that. So some of these choices, I can't go with. Even killing the queen. One, it looks like shit. And the way that it does it, I don't understand what they're going for other than, look what we can do. We're doing something different. I think it just goes off the rails and I don't agree with the way that they decide to do this. I applaud them for wanting to do something different. Take another shot at it.
I find this whole part to be laughable. This is where it goes too far into trash, for lack of a better word. I like the idea of the powers that be stripping Ripley of her feminine reproductive cycle and forcibly implanting it on an alien queen like it's an unnatural part of its anatomy. But the design of this creature, this looks like something I would have seen out of 60s Star Trek. Or this looks like something I would have seen in one of those, not like Nightbreed, but all the imitators, or a bad X-Files episode. It looks awful.
I thought of X-Files, actually. So after the newborn takes out the queen, we hear a high-pitched whine emit from it, and it even sticks out its tongue at her, which I thought was weird. It finally takes out Yellowman, and Ripley runs from it, which if she hatched this newborn and is caressing its head, which was another part I really didn't like. Why is she running from it? I guess she made her decision to go with the humans. Why wouldn't she stay? I thought that was a weird decision. Why wouldn't she stay with her newborn?
Yeah, the decision-making doesn't make sense. Like, you would think you'd have that proud mama moment because they got a third act to finish.
Yeah, and you have to have your hero here for it. Ripley hops ships. When Jonner says, I thought you were dead, she goes, yeah, I get that a lot. Call heads down as we're hearing that the ship is approaching Earth's atmosphere. And the alien reaches for Call as another crew member is beheaded. Ripley heads down to get Call, who's being caressed by the alien, but Ripley stops it and lowers it into a sense of comfort before flinging her blood onto a window, and you guessed it, sending the alien into space. A couple things about this. This is what I said was set up earlier when they said if you blow a hole in it, you're going to take out the entire ship, which is what happens here. But I like this decision she makes. And this is the one time, you know, Weaver is giving some pathos to this because we look at her. She hates the fact that she has to do this. But when it goes out the window, it's not like we've seen before where it just kind of flails into space. This thing is being liquefied and thrown into space. I thought that was wonderful.
We're laughing, right? At this, with it getting sucked out the window?
I'm suffering with Ripley with this. I'm looking at it go out the window little by little, and I'm seeing her being hurt by having to make it suffer like this. I feel like this is a mom getting rid of her son, and this is her suffering for that particular decision.
I feel for Ripley, and I think Sigourney's doing a pretty damn fantastic job. I am laughing at the way this alien newborn looks getting sucked out this window. And I can't believe that for the third out of fourth movies, we're basically doing the airlock ejection just in a different way.
But a different twist on it, which I liked.
It's a twist, and it looks abysmal.
I didn't think it looked that bad. It wasn't that bad.
It looks like Judge Doom at the end of Roger Rabbit.
Fuck, not that bad.
I thought the effects in Moonraker were more convincing than this.
You guys are out of your mind. Ripley and Call grab a hold of one another as the ship descends to Earth, and they get a look at the trusty clouds of their home planet. And I do like the fact Ripley has gone through how many years, and she's finally back on Earth, which if you guys have seen the editor's cut, they actually do land on Earth. And we see, of course, we have a Frenchman here, so we have to have the Eiffel Tower be cut in half as they sit and look at the wreckage. I like the fact that we're up in the air in this cut, and we're not seeing what they've landed on yet, and they still have a sense of hope before they land. I think that's a nice touch.
Actually, I like the director's cut of the ending. But it's just
I hate it.
Because I really like Winona. For those that haven't seen it, you got Call, you got Ripley just sitting together there on Earth. And to me, it's a new hope of what's going to be. Yeah, Earth is a shithole, but we learned that earlier from Jonner. To me, Earth, the final frontier. I like them getting back to Earth and just them having that moment together.
See, I hate that because it ruins the suspense of what they're landing into. Once they get there, it's like, oh, fuck, we've taken out this part of the planet. What's next?
I agree more so with Garrett. See, I can play favorites when I want to.
Boy, Adam, you weren't lying when you said there's going to be blood on this podcast. Colin Ripley checked the scene as Johnner kisses Reese, and Ripley says that Carl did it. She saved Earth. Did he? I don't think so.
I'm pretty sure something entering the atmosphere at that speed would cause a chain reaction to wipe out the planet.
Ripley then says that she doesn't know what happens now as she's a stranger here herself. We get one more shot of the beautiful blue skies littered with clouds as credits roll on Alien Resurrection. Much more confrontational than I was expecting, I gotta say, boys. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Alien Resurrection? Adam, you go ahead and unleash her.
This film, if it more than 3, I thought I was going to go into arms folded and be pissed for the entire runtime, but I was surprised that I was able to enjoy this film more than I thought. I think it does things to change up a franchise that was amazing and then had a downturn. You got to keep it fresh. You got to do something. It had been 20 years since the original. How are you going to get people watching? How are you going to still get your star involved? And I think they did a pretty good way to do that. I think Sigourney Weaver carries everything of this film on her very capable shoulders. The way she slinks through this film like a xenomorph, the way she walks, the way she slides up to people, the way she nuzzles them with their head. She is the embodiment of this franchise for damn good reason. And for that reason alone, this film is worth watching. The other characters around it, you got caricatures, but they're definitely not enjoyable as what we got in Aliens. They are not the Colonial Marines, but they are a step up from what we got in the Prison Planet last week. The storyline, I think it's innovative. I think by separating it again another 200 years, you're able to do something different with it. And I don't know if I applaud it, but I at least don't damn the movie. Don't curse it for it. I got an issue with some of the dialogue, and that's me. But I think everybody comes to play. I think they do a good job. The effects hold up better than I thought they were. I don't like some of the choppy editing. Some of the action scenes get some of that shaky cam cut, 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 cut that bugs me. But those are gone through pretty quick. It's tough because this film, it feels like a different film than the first two. And those first two films are phenomenal. They're amazing. I think they're important to cinema, to screenwriting, to directing, cinematography and everything. This is a different type of movie, but I do think it's worth watching. I do think it's a step up from last week. It's not great, but I was surprised that it's that much better than what I remembered that it was. I'm going to give it a 6. I'm not going to drop to my knees on this film, but I do think it's a better Alien film, better Alien sequel than a lot of people will remember.
All right. 6 from Mr. Bunch. Goudreau, what you say, sir?
Well, I sort of teased at the end of last show, you guys are going to hate me. I think only one person on the show is going to hate me based on Adam's review. For a movie that has been raked over the coals and looped in as just the dregs of this franchise, I am not someone who agrees with that consensus. I have a pretty damn good time with this movie. Is it lowbrow by comparison to the first two movies? Yes. But the movie doesn't crawl up its own ass like Alien 3 did. And the movie didn't piss me off first 30 seconds like that movie did. It never won me back. But this one kind of has an opposite conundrum where I'm really with it. And then once that fucking hybrid comes out, the movie might as well have given birth to all of its goodwill and thrown it out the airlock too. Because I think it's clunky and disorganized as being kind. It's just a sloppy way to end the movie. But for what this movie is, it's a lot of fun for me. And I think the key factor is Sigourney Weaver understanding this role and how it's different because it's an entirely separate character from the Ripley that was in the previous three movies. She is not that. She is something more, something better in her mind when you look at genetics. And the supporting cast, with the exception of Winona Ryder, yeah, these characters don't have a lot on the page. That's why you get people like Ron Perlman and Brad Dourif, because they can do the heavy lifting when the script can't. I have my issues to be sure. I mean, it's no Aliens, but for me, nothing in all likelihood will ever be. The movie's a lot of things, but I don't think this movie is the downtrodden bore that I found Alien 3 to be. It doesn't piss me off like that film does. So I'm far more generous than I thought it would be on a first viewing. I'm going to give this a soft 7. It's flawed. It's definitely not the same DNA that the first two movies are, but much like Ripley 8, I think with a couple further refineries, this could have been a great movie. And I wonder, this is the question I'll ask. If this was Alien 3, like, let's pretend that Alien 3 as we know it didn't happen. You just jump 200 years in the future, they've cloned Ripley. What would the reception have been by comparison? That'd be a fascinating conundrum to talk about and certainly think about. But for what it is, I have a good time. It's a 7 on 10. Sorry, everybody. I like what I like.
Well, for how contentious this podcast sometimes got, I don't think we are too far off from one another. I want to make a comparison that I probably made in the past. I want to say that one of my favorite bands is Garbage, and they released an album back in 2005 called Beautiful Garbage. And when I think of this movie, that's exactly what I find it to be. I think this movie is gorgeous to look at. I love the palette of it. I love the way it looks. And I really think Sigourney Weaver is the one who puts it over the edge for me. I think her acting in this is tremendous as she's trying her best to bring something different to a role she has played 3 times in the past. She has rejected many times of playing it Aliens and Alien 3, like she said, until they brought the money in. And she got a hefty paycheck for this, but I do think she takes this character very, very serious. And this will be her last hurrah in this series, and I think she does it in a very good way. My problem with this movie is who's directing it. Because as much as he brings a great look to this, a lush look to this, he doesn't know what he's making. He is a self-professed non-fan of the series. He is a self-professed non-fan of science fiction. And when you put someone like that in charge of this, you get a movie that is so goddamn distorted. And you know what? As much as I have praised Whedon's writing in this, I do think a lot of that is flawed too. I think there are parts of this that have deep holes that just were never sealed. And it shows in this movie. It is a great movie to look at. And I like it when it's going on. But when it's over, like I mentioned earlier, I think the other 3 films had something to say. This movie really has nothing to say. We're seeing it go on. We're seeing these guys go through this Aliens style as they're shooting aliens, and we're seeing them go underwater. We're having all this go on, but there's no real narrative to this, and there's no real end game to this. Yeah, I think they did have an Alien 5 planned when they get on Earth, and I think Call and Ripley were going to rip through aliens on Earth like we would see later on in this series when we get to Aliens versus Predator, but there is really nothing left to say. But still, Weaver's performance and this film's look bring it up to a 6 for me. I'm giving it the same score I gave last week's film, because while last week's film is a much different film and a much grimmer film, this movie is just the opposite in that it's trying to be lighter and it's fun to watch. But at the end, I don't bring anything else out of it instead of just 1 hour and 48 minutes of, yeah, those people chasing aliens, that was kind of cool. But the Ripley character and everything else, I don't have any real aftertaste to this. So I'm giving this a 6. It's an enjoyable time. But if you get some popcorn and watch this, this is a flat out popcorn movie. There's nothing really else to it. But that ends the Sigourney Weaver era of Aliens. Unless, like she said with this movie, they back up a truck full of money and bring it to her house, she will never do this role again. I don't see her ever doing it. But then again, I didn't see her playing Dana Barrett ever again. And we've seen that a couple times in the last few years. Guys, as we wrap up Alien Resurrection and wrap up Sigourney Weaver's role in this franchise, I mean, how do you think this franchise will be remembered?
I think it'll be remembered as it always has. I think it will continue to have 2 films that are put on pedestals for their respective genres and subgenres. And then you'll have 2 sequels that'll have its defenders, some more than others, but in a large degree, they'll sort of be on a separate playing field as the first two. I don't see a movie like Alien ever being replicated, because there's so many movies that are like the failed clones in this movie. No one's been able to get it 100% right. And Aliens, Lord knows, we've seen a lot of sequels try to be bigger and better, but they kind of miss the intent. You have to do something different at the same time, whether that's tone, whether that's characterization. So I think these movies will live on, and more importantly, this franchise highlights the auteur theory. These are 4 movies that have a lot of the same beats and story, but they're all radically different in terms of execution. And I attribute that to the filmmakers. They all have very clear takes on this material. Even Fincher, who claims nobody hates that movie more than me, as we talked about last week, there's a lot more of his DNA in that movie than even I think he wants to admit. And Janae, yeah, not a self-professed fan, but worked for J.J. Abrams when he said he didn't like Star Trek. Sorry, J.J., I'll keep giving you pot shots until you make something I like, you prick.
Preview for next year, I guess. Adam, what about you, sir? How do you think this franchise will be remembered?
I think it's going to be looked at. I don't want to copy what Matt said, but I'm going to copy a lot of it. I think you're going to have 2 looked at as some of the most important sci-fi films of all time in their respective genres. I think you're going to have ones that are going to show what happens when you deviate. I think also to the auteur theory. I've said that a lot. You have very specific voices that you have spearheading these films. And I think that influences what you watch and what you get out of it. And I think that continues next week for us, you know, when the original comes back, original director. I think Sigourney Weaver, who's done amazing things. I mean, she's done so many amazing roles. I love Gorillas in the Mist for her alone. I think she will always be attached to this role, but I think for good reason. I mean, this is one of the ones that showed that your female characters, especially in sci-fi, don't have to be a damsel in distress. And this is a character who, at the end of the first movie, is fighting off your villain. I mean, she's your final girl in a horror movie, braless in a white tank top and the tiniest panties you've ever seen. She is capable and brave and proud. And I think Sigourney Weaver has birthed Ripley into just one of those icons that won't be matched. It's pretty superb. Alien will never die, especially now that Disney owns it. That's the scary part. But especially the first two films that we got to talk about, I will hold those up to almost any film. And the diminishing returns since then, you got to be in the mood for what you're going to watch. But Alien has its place in history for good reason, because it's fucking earned it.
Yeah, this franchise has spawned two of my favorite female characters, not only in science fiction, but in cinema, with Ripley and Newt. I find so much to love about the nuances that Newt brought in that second film, as well as Ripley's evolution of a character. As much as I didn't really like this particular movie we discussed today, I just love what she brought to it, and that was what sent it over the edge for me. You know, it's always her. Even last week, all of us had pretty bad things to say about Alien 3, but I never discredited Weaver for not bringing her all to a series that she eventually became a co-producer on. But after this, they were going to do an Aliens 5 for a while with the further adventures of Call and Weaver, and then they discarded that, and they did the two Aliens vs. Predator movies, which go back a couple years. We covered those movies a couple years ago when we first launched this thing. And then about 5 years after, actually, no, 4 years after Aliens vs. Predator Requiem, we started hearing word that Ridley Scott was going to come back to this series. And then by the time 2012 rolled around, you know what? I could not have been more excited for next week's film. I think the only thing that exceeded that expectation was when Phantom Menace came out. That's how excited I was for Prometheus. Matt, how excited were you for Prometheus, and what are you expecting when we discuss that movie next week?
Well, my hype certainly doesn't equate to yours, but that's not to say I wasn't anticipating it, because the movie had some phenomenal viral marketing, as were the trailers. But as I've sort of alluded to, I'm not, while I love Aliens, and I certainly hold Alien in the high esteem as well, I wouldn't call this one of my favorite franchises, and Ridley Scott's not one of my favorite directors, especially in the aughts, or the noughties, depending on what you want to call it. Please don't call it the noughties, everybody. Just call it the aughts. I fucking hate that name. What scared me is the cliched thing. It's a prequel, and Damon Lindelof was writing it. I know everybody took their pot shots at the man, but if you watched Lost, it wasn't exactly unwarranted. So there were a lot of reasons to be excited. I thought it had a great cast that was lined up. And like I said, the trailers were great, but I'd be lying to you if I said I was not overly excited, because look, The Avengers was coming out that summer. Skyfall was coming out that year. There were properties that are nearer and dearer to me that I had more hype for. Even Dark Knight Rises. You know, we gave our thoughts on that movie. Not that you'll be able to listen to it, so we may have to redo those as the three of us. That had a shitload of hype behind it. It was just a busy year. So I gave myself excitement, but I wasn't first in line to see it.
Adam, you and I were back to being best friends around this time. I remember 2012 very well. What were you thinking when Prometheus was starting to roll around?
To Matt's point, there was so much that was going on. I knew Ridley was back. That had me excited. But the problem that I had was the way that it was being told that it was an alien film, that it wasn't an alien film. So while the viral marketing looked beautiful, and I stayed around from the online videos for the most part, all those that they put out, it looked beautiful what I saw being shown. But I didn't know what I was getting. Now, when I was told, ooh, it's the space jockeys, I was like, okay, do we need this story? Because prequels have let me down over and over and over again. So Ridley had me excited. Other than that, I was like, eh, we'll see how it goes. So I wasn't overly excited, but I wasn't dreading it either.
So excited. God, I was excited. And we'll get into all that next week. But you know what else, boys? I got to mention, we are what, we're a couple weeks, 2-3 weeks away as we record this from the release of the new Alien film, Alien Romulus. Guys, I hate to say this because I hate the director and I hate the fact that he's doing a franchise that is so near and dear to me. But as this movie gets closer,
don't say it.
I can't believe I'm finding myself anticipating it more than I was expecting. I am.
You're setting yourself up. I hope you realize this.
I know I am. And I know I'm going to probably walk out pretty disappointed by the time this podcast airs. I'm not going to say my thoughts on it, obviously, until we actually record that podcast and it's actually posted. But I got to say, I'm getting kind of excited. I can't believe I'm saying it. But that'll be remedied in a couple weeks. Boys, thank you for joining me on this ride around the space jockey. And until next week, who do I have to fuck to get off this podcast? Thank you, gentlemen.
Not me.
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Now what the fuck are we supposed to do?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Could kill him. I won't even take that chance. Just cut it off and then.
You take responsibility?
Yes, I'll just take the responsibility. Get him out of here.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How far would you go to get what you came all this way for? Your answers.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including Star Wars, the Mad Max movies, Avatar, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Stop your grinning and drop your linen.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Shit.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
How are you, you stupid cat?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You started this. Show me everything. I can handle myself.
Yeah, I noticed.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
They ain't paying us enough for this, man.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Thank you, that will be all.
God damn it, that's not all! Because if one of those things gets down here, then that will be all. Then all this bullshit that you think is so important, you can just kiss all that goodbye! Thank you.
Freeman and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
Commercial Starship Nostromo. Third officer reporting. The other members of the crew. Kane, Lambert, Parker, Brett, Ash, and Captain Dallas are dead. Cargo and ship destroyed. I should reach the frontier in about 6 weeks. With a little luck, the network will pick me up. This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.
That's it, man. Game over, man. Game over.
He did Crash the year before, not the Crash you're thinking of. He made a movie where James Spader fucks a car for all intents and purposes.
I saw that in theaters.
We saw that together.
That's right. You were with us. Yeah.
Yep. And it was right. We were making a big deal that NC-17 had just come out as a rating.
Yep. Yeah. It was that. That and Showgirls were the two that tried to bring it back, and then both of those movies bombed. And it went away.
It went away pretty quick. They then went to a guy we've spoken about in the past, but would make his own dark science fiction film in the same year, a guy by the name of Paul W. Anderson.
This fucking guy.
Yeah, another one who just keeps fucking popping up.
He made his own space movie called Event Horizon, which is...
Yeah, the same year.
I don't understand why people like that movie. I don't get it.
I don't either. I think Adam does. Adam, yeah, you love
I
that movie.
I know Adam does.
One of them has this movie on his watch list regularly, so hang on because I'm showing my daughter it this year. Stay tuned.
I need to talk to that girl.
And in the Mouth of Madness. We're doing a double feature.
Holy Christ. All right. So.
The humanity of who she was is kind of gone. And I think if the memories were completely removed, you know what you would have had? You would have had her coming across a computer of video diaries. And we would have had a montage of her watching herself and learning how everything else came to be. That's what they would have done.
Oh, God.
Jesus.
Would have been the first episode of Loki.
That's exactly.
But it's also this movie has a challenge.
So we have General Perez, a.k.a. Dan Hedayas, fresh from the Tortellis. And and of course, he was in Blood Simple, too, which is probably what Janae saw him in.
Well, Usual Suspects, speaking of Bryan Singer.
Oh, he was in Usual Suspects. I always forget that. I've only seen that movie once in my life. I've never revisited it.
Well, that's because it works really well at a first viewing, and then you're like, oh, I know where this is going, so I don't care anymore.
That's true. General Perez says that they are... Yeah, and they were really taking over, too, because don't forget, earlier this year, they had the Lost World as well. So digital effects were taking over.
Shoot, really 18 months from The Matrix, which is crazy to think about.
Well, let's not forget, this was also the year of Batman and Robin.
Man, 97 was some year, wasn't it?
Yeah, and we Titanic.
Yeah, Titanic, month later.
Men in Black had some groundbreaking effects. Fifth Element was this year.
Mm-hmm.
It was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
We are then introduced to some of the...
It's funny that a guy named Leland Orser plays Wesley in the universe that has a character named Leland Owlsley.
So Ripley says, I don't know what to respond to that with. Ripley says that he Boys, thank you for joining me on this ride around the space jockey. And until next week, who do I have to fuck to get off this podcast? Thank you, gentlemen.
Not me.
Dang it. I can't believe I didn't see that line coming.